Hello, everybody, and welcome to another beautiful Thursday morning. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And I have a great show planned for all of you today. My guest will be Leah Lizarondo. She is the co-founder and CEO of 412 Food Rescue. And I'll tell you more about that in a little bit when I have her come on. But first, of course, I want to share with you some things going on in the news, some things going on in and around our area, and my weekly recipe. So I'm really happy to have all of you joining us. First, the big news is Putzer is out of the running. He has stepped down from being approved as the labor, in charge of the labor department, and I can't say I'm more thrilled. Now we just have to do the same thing for Scott Pruitt. And the thing that is so amazing is that when you realize that it was the news that really brought this out, I mean, the Trump administration knew about all of the talks with, also with Flynn. I'm sorry, I'm going to Flynn right now. The Trump administration knew about all the talks that his administration was having with Russia for weeks prior to this news coming out. But, you know, he did nothing about it. It took that news coming out to really make Flynn step out, realizing he didn't have the backing, even amongst the Republicans. And then for Putzer, he realized a tape came out about his abuse at home, and that once that hit the news, he knew that he had to step down too. So the administration is doing its thing. It's unraveling. And we, the people, have to stay vigilant to hold our news people accountable and hold the administration and our congressmen all accountable so that what is right prevails. And, you know, we know having Scott Pruitt as in charge of the EPA is certainly a no-brainer that cannot be approved. He is a man who, as Attorney General for Oklahoma, sued the EPA numerous times. He has been a big proponent of oil and coal, and he is not a supporter of new renewable energies, and he's just a bad guy to run the EPA. So anyway, we need to stay vigilant on that and make sure that he also does not get through. We also have the pipelines to deal with. We have, you know, the Keystone XL pipeline that was finally put on hold by the Obama administration and now has a green light to go ahead. And there's the Line 3 pipeline, which is even bigger, that is moving forward as well. And we need to stop that, as well as, of course, Standing Rock. So there's pipelines that are just moving forward, and we realize as you look at the history of pipelines, they all leak. They all leak. There's no such thing as a pipeline that's not going to leak, and our environment just can't handle it. So we need to stay vigilant on that realm, too. We need to support the nation of indigenous people who are trying to protect their land and where they live and their drinking water. So we need to support each other. We need to come together, and that's one silver lining of this administration, because they are so bad, it is really bringing all the grassroots organizations together with one goal, and that is to bring that administration down. So that's a good thing. Lots of things going on around the city. A few weeks ago, I had Jennifer Harris on my show from the Rudd Center of Food Policy and Obesity, and we were talking about how marketing to the Hispanic and African-American communities is so intense, and how, you know, the epidemic proportions of obesity and diabetes in those communities is really, really high. And so the Cornell Cooperative Extension here on Long Island, the Suffolk County one, is hosting a bunch of different classes to really go into communities that are struggling with these issues and offering free classes at libraries. So there's a whole slew of them. I'm posting them on my website, but starting Tuesday, February 21st, there's an 8-week series that's called Healthy Children, Healthy Families, and it's being given in Spanish. It's an 8-week course that's supporting parents and caregivers on nutrition, parenting practices, and physical activity. And it's a group discussion, and it's interactive, and it's really should be great. It's going to be held at the Suffolk County Cornell Cooperative Extension building in Riverhead. So registration's required, but it is free, and it's really, you know, if you know anyone in those communities that could benefit from that, please share this. There's also one called Snack Attack. That's at the Central ISOP Library. There's Adding Fruits and Vegetables to Your Everyday Meals. That's at the Wyandanch Library. Eating Better on a Budget. Another one's called My Plate Families, and that's going over the 5 food groups. So it's really a basic nutrition education class, and it's being taught by Amy Bly, who is a nutritionist and working for Cornell Cooperative Extension. So if you know anyone that would benefit from those, you can go right onto the Cornell Cooperative Extension's website in Suffolk County or check out my website. Also, starting this weekend, Hawthorne Valley Biodynamic Farm is having their winter intensive, and it's from Sunday, February 19th through Friday, February 24th. There's a sliding scale for the cost. It includes lunch and dinner. I think there's still a few spots left, but if you don't know about biodynamics, it's like, I like to call it organic on steroids. I mean, it's really just a wonderful philosophy in growing vegetables. It really looks at the earth from a spiritual side as well as a way of growing the vegetables. And so it's a beautiful way of growing your vegetables. They taste unbelievable. They have the highest nutritional value. So if you're available and you're interested, Hawthorne Valley is a wonderful biodynamic farm up in the Hudson Valley. Sugar Maple Day, if you're interested in learning how maple sugar is made, or maple syrup, come on out to the Benner Family Farm out in Setauket on February 25th. They're having a demonstration, and you can go onto their website to find out more information. But all of these things, by the way, are on my website at IE Green. Friday, February 24th, up in Boston at Harvard University, there's a Global Food and 2017 Symposium, and this is an open event to the public. It's free. It's from 12:30 to 4:30. And it's an afternoon of 24 speed talk presentations on the nexus of food, agriculture, environment, health, and society. If you are up in that area, certainly worth checking out. This is the time to really think about beekeeping. If you are interested in raising bees, this is the time you need to be thinking about it. You need to be learning about it. You need to be ordering your bees. So there is an online bee course being given through Cornell starting March 2nd through April 30th, and the course is $280, but there is a discount you can get as well, and I also think they have some scholarships. But the course is being taught by experienced beekeepers and the New York State Honey Bee Extension, and should be very informative. It's Thursday evenings from 6:30 to 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. So if you're interested, check that out. There's also many bee courses being offered locally. So, you know, you can just Google that and find out about bee classes in your area. March 6th is the Food Policy for Breakfast series, a continuation up at Hunter College Food Policy Organization. Charles Plackin will discuss with a variety of chefs who are working to improve the food system. This is a free ongoing lecture series that they provide up at the Food Policy Center at Hunter College, and they have them about every month or so, sometimes even more. This one's March 6th, and they're in the morning from 8:30 to 10. They provide a free healthy breakfast, and it's always very informative. I go when I can. I really enjoy going, and it's a wonderful time to meet other people who are involved in food policy in the city. March 9th and 10th is a NOFA New York brainstorming session in the New York area. NOFA New York is the Northeast Organic Farming Association, and there's chapters everywhere. And in the Northeast area, there's one for every state. But New York is trying to expand their presence here on Long Island and in the city. So we had one on Long Island last month. And upcoming March 9th and 10th, there's going to be one in Park Slope, Brooklyn, and the other one is going to be in Manhattan. So they're really trying to brainstorm and get people's ideas as to how they can service you more. So if you're involved in community gardens, urban gardens, and are interested in getting involved and learning about NOFA and what they could possibly do to help what you're doing, please come to these brainstorming sessions. They're also free, and they're really great. March 10th, Standing Rock and the Native Nations are having a march in Washington, D.C., and there's so many marches coming up. Again, it's just wonderful to see people coming together and mobilizing. This is going to be in Washington, D.C. There's very possibly going to be a sister march and marches in other cities in solidarity with this march in Washington, D.C., but this is on March 10th, all day in Washington, to bring different indigenous grassroots leaders and organizations together to march peacefully and to raise awareness about the need to support Native indigenous people in this country and to keep their land, the little bit of land that we've given them, free of pollutants, and they need access to clean drinking water, and these pipelines are going to get in the way of that. March 12th, Slow Food Long Island, Slow Food North Shore, and the Cinema Arts Center are coming together to bring the fourth annual Food and Film Feast. This is always a great, great evening. We show a series of short documentary films paired with a speaker and a food. And so it ends up being like an eight-course meal that is prepared by I.E. Green and members of our Slow Food chapter. And we have some great speakers. A few of the films I'll share with you. Deeply Rooted is a wonderful film about preserving local foods, and we will be highlighting an Arc of Taste food called Long Island Cheese Pumpkin, and we'll be making a pumpkin soup with that. We're also going to have a really fun taste test. We have two films. One is The Leafy Green Machine, talking about hydroponic growing and if that is a way to actually feed the planet with the growing population. It certainly takes up less land, less water, less soil. But the questions of whether it's really organic is always coming up. So we're showing another film alongside it called Keep the Soil Inorganic. And then we have two speakers, one from a hydroponic farm in Brooklyn and one speaker from an organic farm out east. And we'll be doing a taste test with the two different types of salad and having a lively discussion about hydroponics versus organic and whether hydroponic needs its own label. Can you really call something that is grown hydroponically organic if it has no access to soil and sunlight, when that is one of the definitions of organic? So it should be really interesting. And then we have a film talking about the marketing to the Hispanic communities and how deep that marketing goes, how, you know, the film is just very moving, talking, you know, it's a woman, a young woman talking about how they almost feel like they're not being hospitable if they don't offer Coke and junk food when people come over. It's so ingrained in their culture, and so how we can break that. And we have a guest speaker, adolescent and pediatric physician who will be talking, who works a lot with the Hispanic communities, who will be talking about that. Then we have another film on the model of a restaurant that is a pay-what-you-can model. And we have someone who is starting up one of those restaurants here on Long Island coming to be our speaker. And then we have a film about maple syruping and the gateway bug. A lot of talk of raising bugs for food is also coming up a lot. I was at Terra Madre in Italy for the Slow Food big annual, biannual event. And I went to a fancy event, and one of the dishes they served was risotto with crickets. So it's going to be starting to hit menus, even in the U.S., sometime soon. And it's already starting to show up as cricket flour, which ends up being a high-protein, gluten-free flour, and lots of desserts are being made with that. So anyway, another wonderful discussion. We'll have two speakers, the filmmakers from the film, The Gateway Bug. So it should be a great evening. If you are around, this event sells out quick. We only have room for 100 people. So if you're interested, go onto the Cinema Arts Center website and purchase your tickets. $60 for members of the cinema or Slow Food and $70 for the public. March 12th and 13th, the Just Food Conference, the annual Just Food Conference is happening. That is always a wonderful event. It's happening up at the Teachers College at Columbia University. And, you know, they bring together people working in the food system in New York, urban farmers, school lunch people, you know, to really talk about the issues around racial and economic inequalities in the system and what can be done about it. So that's always a great event. And there's so many more, but I don't want to take the time. So do check out these events on my website. There's just two other marches I do want to tell you about, actually. One is the March for Science that's taking place in Washington, D.C. on April 22nd, and then the big climate march on April 29th. And that one, I know there will be another march in New York as well. So these are great, great events. Do check them out, and I hope to see some of you there. So now I just want to share my recipe with you really quickly before I invite Leah Lizarondo on to talk to us about 412 Food Rescue. And this is an oat and nut raspberry Linzer tart. I know I've shared this recipe before, but it has not been on my website for some reason. So people have been asking for it. So I'm going to share it again and post it again. So this recipe makes about 20 to 22 cookies, depending on the size that you make. You need 1 cup of ground nuts. So you can use any combination, almonds, walnuts, pecans. And each one, of course, has its particular flavor. So you can use a combination or just one. And you can try them with, you know, one time make it with walnuts, one time make it with pecans, and see what you like. But you need a cup of ground nuts. So if you're putting them in the food processor, you want to measure it after you pulse it and grind it up. And you can leave it a little bit, you know, with some texture. You don't want to make it completely smooth like a flour, but you do want it to be fairly fine. And then you can do the same thing with your oats. If you want this to be gluten-free, you can find some gluten-free oats and use that. And when it comes to the flour, you can also use gluten-free flour. So you want 1 cup of ground oats, 1 cup of whole wheat pastry flour or a gluten-free flour, 1/4 teaspoon of cinnamon, 1 pinch of salt, 1/2 cup of maple syrup, and 1/2 cup of a GMO-free canola oil or sunflower oil or safflower oil, just a light oil, and 1 jar of an organic raspberry jam. And you're going to combine all the ingredients except for the jam in a large bowl. You know, I usually mix the dry together first, just for my baking protocol. And then I make a hole in the center and I pour in the maple syrup and canola oil that I've mixed together already. And I add that into the bowl and mix it all up. And then to shape the cookies, I wet my hands first so that the dough doesn't stick to my hands. And I make the dough into like 1-inch balls that size. And then I flatten them out in my hands and place it down on a greased cookie sheet that I line with some parchment paper. And I do that until the whole, all the batter is used up. Then I go back with a wet thumb and I, or fingers, and I make little indentations in the center of each cookie. And that's where I'm going to put the jam. And you fill it with your favorite jam. I use raspberry jam, just I like the color, but blueberry is also really great. Strawberry is great. Whatever you'd like. And you just fill that into the center. And then you bake them at 350 for 10 minutes. And then turn the cookie sheet around and bake it for another 5 minutes. If you have a convection oven and, you know, the heat is evenly distributed, you don't need to do that turning of the cookie sheet. But for me, the back of my oven is always hotter than the front, so I need to do that. And then I remove them from the oven and let them cool a little bit before transferring them. Once they cool, they will get crispy, and they're really delicious. They're so easy to make, and everybody loves them. I usually make them gluten-free, and they're always vegan, and they're just great. So enjoy that, and of course, let me know how you like them. I always love hearing from everybody after you make my recipes. Okay, so it's now my pleasure to introduce to all of you Leah Lizardo. She is the founder and CEO of 412 Food Rescue, which is a nonprofit organization that's working to eliminate hunger and promote healthy environments. And right now they're in the Pittsburgh area and are looking to expand out, and I'll let her tell you more about it. But basically they are rescuing viable food that otherwise would go to waste and redirecting it to food pantries and other areas where people are in need. So, Leah, are you with me?
Yes. Hi, Bhavani.
Hi, Leah. Thank you so much for joining us.
I'm happy to be here.
Great. So I thought before I actually, you know, dive into my questions, maybe you can just give us a little bit of background of, you know, what inspired you to start 412 Food Rescue and a little bit of your background, where you come from.
Yeah, my background is pretty diverse. I started out in consumer goods marketing, who works for a Fortune 500 company in New York City for a number of years, and moved on to technology and then nonprofits. I worked for a nonprofit venture capital firm here in Pittsburgh after I graduated from Carnegie Mellon, and was always looking to merge all of those into something I was passionate about, and that is food and healthy food access. So I started writing about food about 5 years ago and realized that, you know, there's one thing that the food movement hasn't been talking about enough, and that's quickly changing, of course, especially in the last couple of years, and that is the fact that the food industry throws away almost half of everything it produces. So that was a big moment for me, especially since we talk so much about hunger and health. And, you know, those conversations are usually couched around, you know, how do we make more food? Well, the fact is we have enough food. We just have to get it to people and not landfills.
Right, because also when it's in a landfill, it's also then creating methane gas and creating more pollution. So it's,
correct.
So when you get it to people who need it, obviously it's a win-win all the way around.
Right. And, you know, and the resources that were put into the production of that food, you know, all throughout the cycle of that food is wasted.
Right.
Right.
So, and before that, you worked for another wonderful organization that I love called Dress for Success. How long were you with
them? Correct. Yeah, so I was CEO of Dress for Success here in Pittsburgh for about 4 years. And that was something that was, you know, a great experience for me. It was my first nonprofit that I led, and really was proud to contribute to advancing women in the workplace.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I know of that organization, and I just think, you know, it's another wonderful wonderful nonprofit that's, you know, doing good stuff. But anyway,
yes,
let's go back to 412 Food Rescue. So when did you first start that?
So we founded 412 Food Rescue in March 2015, officially. And we received our first funding around November of that year. And last year was our first full year of operations.
Wow, so you're really a young organization.
We are, barely 2 years old.
Uh-huh, and you started in Pittsburgh. And are you still just in Pittsburgh, or have you expanded out? I know I was reading a lot about the organization, and that's your goal. But right now, are you still in Pittsburgh?
We are in Pittsburgh and gearing up to equip other cities to do what we're doing here.
That's great. So so how did you actually get it started and off the ground?
I think it was really one step at a time. You know, one of the biggest things about food waste is that half of all the food that is wasted, almost half of it happens at the retail level. And that's really a big logistics challenge, you know, because food at that level, surplus food at that level happen in small quantities, in very mixed, you know, quantities, very unpredictable. So it's really hard to work with, you know, the traditional and existing logistics models that are out there. And when I talk about logistics models, I mean, you know, we see big trucks going to warehouses, and in warehouses, the food gets picked and stored before they get deployed again to, you know, other locations. And that lead time doesn't, you know, the quantity and the lead time doesn't work for food that's about to go to waste. And so what's been happening is that, absent of any other options, retailers have been throwing away this food. So what we decided was that, you know, we will tackle this particular segment of the supply chain and really understand how we could, you know, gather this food. And we took our inspiration from, you know, things that technology has enabled, and that includes crowdsourcing. So through technology and social media, we've crowdsourced, you know, one of the largest food transportation networks, powered only by volunteers. So yeah, that's how we scaled up. And last year, we hit our 1 million mark of rescued food, 1 million pounds.
Wow. Excellent.
Yeah.
You know, I've heard them calling you the Uber of food rescue.
Right, and because it works primarily in the same manner. So all our volunteers download our app, they have it on their phone, and when there's a food rescue near them, you know, or a passenger, as we call it, so we call it tuber, because it's mostly, you know, vegetables and potatoes. You know, they get alerts, you know, there's a food rescue near you, are you willing to take it? And then they click on it and said, yeah, I'm going to take it. And then they drive to wherever the pickup is, and they take their passenger, which could be a case of vegetables or, you know, a carload of bread, to the nonprofit that it's assigned to.
Uh-huh. And do they have a choice as to what nonprofit they can bring it to, like one that's closest to where they are, or do you direct them as to where to go?
We direct them to where to go. So we match the food that's available to the appropriate nonprofits, because we work with a whole range of nonprofits, anywhere from housing sites that house, you know, 350 people to a shelter that feeds 20 people. So depending on the size of the donation to the distance, you know, we kind of match those dynamically.
Uh-huh, and that's done by a person, or that's done through an algorithm from the app?
So it's done by a person currently, but in the next iteration of our app, it will be done via an algorithm.
Uh-huh. Amazing. And so this is this app that you've developed, is this what you're hoping to be able to share with other cities to apply it to a local region and make it, you know, make it able to be replicated?
Correct. So we are now gearing up. We've received, you know, almost over 200 inquiries from other cities, and we are gearing up to have hold two webinars. We will announce those via our social media and our website to just get information from the cities that are interested. We are looking for nonprofits that are able to kind of turnkey this. That way we can pilot it quickly in the first round of cities, and then as we improve the process, pilot it to more cities.
We have an organization on Long Island that is very dear to my heart called Community Solidarity. They used to be called
yep.
Food Not Bombs, and now they're Community Solidarity.
Yes.
And mm-hmm. they do a similar thing, but it's, you know, they don't have an app, so they do it through Facebook. So,
right.
you know, they find different places that have food that needs rescue, and then they also have their own community sharing sites. So 6 days a week, they're in a different location, and they bring the food to each of those locations. And it is amazing the amount
yes.
of food. I mean, sometimes, you know, the volunteers end up taking food home because there's more food than the needy people need, you know? I mean, it's amazing how much food.
And that's in that in itself, that sentence, you know, more food than needy people need, it's amazing to me. You know, we talk about food insecurity, and there's so many people who need food. But it gives you an idea, you know, when we rescue food, when we have really big donations, one of the things we notice is that we create a temporary market flood, meaning there's so much food suddenly available that our nonprofit partners don't even have the capacity to say yes. You know, so that
right.
gives you an idea of how much food there is actually out there. You know, I really feel like we are scratching the surface of how much we can, you know, we can use surplus food to actually fight hunger.
Right, right. And the one thing I just want to clarify for my listeners is, in this country, you know, it's 40%, which is, like you said, is almost half at the retail level. But in third world countries, it's actually not at the retail level. It's more at the right at the farm. It's at the, you know, the growing level,
correct.
They just can't distribute it. So, you know, in our country,
yes.
is that it's in a different place than it is in some other places. So, just
right,
to clarify,
right. So, in
there's still
right.
the same quantity of food being wasted. It's just
correct.
Not yet processed, and it's going to waste before it even gets to the retail place.
Correct. Yes.
Yeah.
So, in developing countries, it's actually called food loss, because a lot of it has to do with, you know, there's not enough technology to either store the food, harvest the food immediately, defend it from, you know, natural disasters. So it's a loss of food right at the farm level.
Right.
And then for us in developing countries, it's actually food waste, because we have harvested this these resources. We're just, you know, putting it, you know, it's not going from farm to table, it's going from farm to landfill.
Right. And like you said, it's not just the food that's being lost, it's also the waste, all the resources that went into the production of the food. You know, the
correct.
The money and the labor costs, all the different parts of it
yes.
that went
yep.
into the production. So, mm-hmm. yeah, it's a real problem, and it's just amazing. Now, when I was reading about your company, you actually found some other ways to deal with it, because I think one of the things, when I say there's so much, even more food than the needy need, one of the
right.
biggest waste is bread. I mean, because bread has such a short shelf life. And so if
correct.
You think of every bakery, you know,
yep.
at the end of their day, they're basically throwing
yep.
out garbage bags full of
right.
bread, and they don't have the resources or the time to go deliver it. Plus it's at, you know, 10 o'clock at night when they're closing, or whatever time they're closing, they don't have
mm-hmm.
a place to go and bring it. So
yeah. Yeah.
Can you share with us what you did with all the extra bread you were collecting?
Yeah. So, artisan bread, you know, people don't sell day old artisan bread. So what we've done is that we have collected, some of this bread and created beer out of it, which we called loaf. We partnered with a local brewer, and he was up for the challenge, and he created a really good IPA. And that was a big hit locally, and it was covered in, you know, all the national food magazines, including All About Beer. So that's a really great project, fun project that we took on last year, and we're going to do again this year. A couple of other things we've done is that we harvested all the wild, what we call urban wild trees in Pittsburgh during the fall season. And we took up the crab apples, all the wild apples that no one was taking care of. And we worked with a local distiller, and we created an apple brandy. Actually, it's a Pommeau, which is apple brandy with cider. It's a liqueur. And again, that was really delicious, and it was a good way for us to kind of talk about food waste in a more accessible manner. Everyone loved it. So those are the two products we launched last year. We're looking at launching other products this year that can help kind of catalyze conversation.
Uh-huh. In addition to that, what happens to the profit that is then generated from these things? I mean, you know, obviously when you're picking up the food rescue and taking it to a nonprofit, there's no exchange there of money.
No.
What happens with, you know, making the IPA? Does the brewery benefit from the free bread, or does the brewery volunteer? Do you split it with them? Do you, you know, where does the money that then's generated, does that go to help support your projects?
Yeah, so all profits from those two initiatives went to 412 Food Rescue. So we're really thankful to our partners that allowed us to do that.
Great. Great. I'm glad to hear that.
Mm-hmm.
That's wonderful.
Yeah.
So, Leah, let's take a couple-minute break, and when we come back, I want to hear some of the wonderful stories. Maybe you can share a couple stories with us, and also some of the challenges, because I know we've all seen, you know, little clips on YouTube and wherever of CVS's and Walmart, places that are throwing out food that won't let you go out into the dumpster and take it, that won't give you the food. They want rather see it go to the garbage. And I'm really curious how you deal with that, because it seems so impossible. But anyway, everyone listening, don't go anywhere. I'm talking with Leah Lizarondo from 412 Food Rescue, and you're listening to Bhavani at Ayat Green, and we will be right back.
It's not liberal, it's not conservative, it's progressive, the truth that empowers. Right here on PRN, the Progressive Radio Network.
Given these complex times, we all need to connect the dots, and that's what we do on my show every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time. I'm Allison Rose Levy, and I welcome environmentalists, thought leaders, media critics, advocates, health experts, and authors to an in-depth dialogue about how all facets of social choices impact health, food, and the environment. Check out all my past shows at prn.fm in the show archives. There are some great thought leaders sharing their ideas and letting you know what you can do to change our world. Please join us.
Hi, this is Gerald Celente. If you want to stay ahead of the news and on top of the trends, join me every Wednesday at 11 a.m. Eastern Time here on Progressive Radio Network for Trends This Week, where you can hear history before it happens.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And Leah Lizarondo is my guest today. She's the founder and CEO of 412 Food Rescue. Leah, are you back with me?
Yes, I'm here.
Great. So can you share with us, you know, one of your favorite success stories that, you know, of some food that you were able to rescue and the recipients of that?
Yeah, so one of our favorite stories is the day we got a letter from the Housing Authority of the City of Pittsburgh. And basically, they are the housing authority for all the housing sites, public housing sites for the city. And they are a partner that we welcomed last year. They are, you know, housing sites are not traditional hunger organizations. You know, they provide housing. But one of the things that we have wanted to do is be able to solve the distance problem. And that is really, you know, if you are a single mother working two jobs with three kids under five, you know, you have no time to go to even a pantry. You know, can you imagine taking those three kids on a bus to go to a pantry? It's really, really hard.
Right.
So even if you have access to free food, it's hard to get to it. So, you know, our thesis was, you know, what if we take the food to where people already are? So that's how we partnered with the Housing Authority. And so we've been doing it for a few months. And one day we received a letter from the authority that said that, you know, since you have been working with us, we have had zero calls for food insecurity, meaning every month the Housing Authority would get 5 to 7 calls, you know, asking for help in terms of giving a family food because they have run out of food. And since we have started working with them, they have received zero calls, meaning we have truly impacted food insecurity within the housing sites in Pittsburgh. And that is a big deal to us because that proves that, you know, this, what we're doing is needed and it is working.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And so do you go to many different sites within the different projects that are in Pittsburgh area, or is it just one particular spot?
No, we work with the authorities. We work with many of their housing sites. We also work with our county housing authority, so even beyond the city.
And do you have set days that you go into different communities that people know to show up? Because that's the organization I was talking about, the Community Solidarity, is
right.
In a different location once a week, and people know that every Thursday they're here and every Sunday they're there. And so people plan it, you know, into their schedules.
Yes. So we do have regular drops, but we also have ad hoc drops because that's the nature of surplus food. So our truck, we have one truck that kind of deals with larger donations. And if we somehow get a large donation, like this week, I think we had 300 bags of cabbage that we had to distribute, and each bag is 50 pounds each. And so, mm-hmm. you know, at those points, you know, those are ad hoc donations, so they get it in addition to their scheduled drop.
Now, do you break it up, or you expect one family to take 50 pounds of carrots?
No, we break it up.
You do, uh-huh. Right. Right, because that would be hard. Mm-hmm. I eat a lot of carrots, but 50 pounds is a lot.
I know.
Uh-huh. And how do you deal with refrigeration? I know, you know, like sometimes I work with a nonprofit food pantry here, you know, a bunch of times a year, mostly during the holiday time. I organize community efforts, and we actually create like a Thanksgiving feast, a dinner feast, and we feed homeless people out on the streets. And you know, through that work, I sometimes make, you know, partnerships where, you know, I'll get a call saying they have, you know, thousands of pounds of, like, frozen seafood that has to come out of a warehouse. And I, you know, try to find someone who has a truck that can go and pick it up. How do you deal with that? You know, like, if you need refrigerated trucks, or do you have any donated refrigeration so that you can store stuff, or do you really literally have to get it and drop it?
So we're a direct transfer organization. We don't have any warehousing capabilities and probably never will. Because of the nature of surplus and rescued food, most of the food needs to be used within a few days. So it really won't work storing it. So what we do is that most of what we rescue, about 60% of what we rescue, is fresh fruits and vegetables. So those don't really require special refrigeration.
And no, what's so great is that's what's lacking in food pantries. You know,
exactly.
Fresh fruits and vegetables is not what they get because of the nature of it going bad.
Correct. So because we directly transfer to organizations that can distribute them the same day, you know, we are able to provide access to this, whereas it was impossible before. So we very rarely distribute what we call, you know, highly perishable, I mean, temperature controlled food. And, you know, seafood is, I don't even remember the last time we rescued that.
Right.
And then if we do get meat, we get it frozen already, and we give it to soup kitchens that have capacity to store it.
Right, right. And have you run into places that have food waste that will not give it to you? Are you aware of, you know, those or companies that say it's against policy and they just dump it in the dumpster?
Yes, I mean, we've come across those, and those are really unfortunate. I mean, the industry is getting more and more educated, you know, as, you know, show podcasts like yours, you know, mainstream media talk about it more. There's actually a federal law that protects everyone in the donation cycle that was signed 20 years ago. And it's called the Bill Emerson Good Samaritan Act. And this absolves everyone from liability except in the cases of gross negligence, which, you know, I don't think happens, you know, if you're donating food. So this is really something that is a misperception that we are trying to re-educate donors or potential donors of. I think one of the things that really prevent donors from donating is that they're scared that it's going to impact their operations. And we try to make it as easy as possible for donors to do that. So, yes, it's really educating people on the actual risks of liability and also the fact that it's not going to impact their operations negatively.
Uh-huh. And what about prepared food? You know, people left over from a wedding or, you know, a bar mitzvah or something like that. Do you go and collect that as well, or are there other organizations that are doing that?
So we work with caterers we cannot work with individuals at the moment. So when we do get alerts of these things, hopefully we get them in advance and we can tell whoever's having the wedding or bar mitzvah that, can you get us in touch with your caterer? And then we will work with the caterer to arrange for a pickup. And the reason for that is we want someone on the other end of that donation to be food safety certified and ensure that they understand what is safe and what's not safe.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that's so important. I know when I cook for, you know, the Thanksgiving feast, you know, some local person said, oh, I have a group I can ask them to donate already cooked turkeys so that you're not having to cook all the turkeys yourself. And I was like, great. And that was the only year I got all these turkeys. And as I'm serving it, I'm starting to see bubbles, you know. I'm like, oh, my God, because I am certified food safety. And I know food handling. Yeah. So now when I do it, I send out a whole food handling safety guide
Correct.
To all the with the request for turkeys so that people understand you can't defrost the turkey overnight on the counter. You know, that's
Correct.
Just not okay. So, and I haven't had that problem since. So it really is, you know, a learned skill, how to keep it safe. And that's so important, especially, you know, if you're going to stand by the Good Samaritan Act, you really need to know what's safe and what's not. So what has been some of your biggest challenges in trying to build 412 Food Rescue?
The challenges. It's really keeping up with the growth. Because Food Rescue is such a young organization, we're barely scratching the tip of the iceberg. There's so much more to rescue. You know, when I say 1 million pounds, that's such a nice round number, but there's millions and millions more. So it's really trying to understand how can we scale quickly, and then how can we ensure that, you know, the whole supply chain, meaning up to the nonprofit partners, you know, how can we fix bottlenecks in that? You know, you brought up storage. We work with some nonprofits that can distribute food to many people, but they've never done that before. But so how can we equip these nonprofits, because, you know, mothers already go to them like subsidized daycare centers. You know, why not, you know, when the mother picks up the food, you know, she can also bring home a bag of groceries. You know, so, but how can we equip the daycare center so that they are able to do that? So things like that, it's like understanding bottlenecks in the pipeline, you know, understanding how to scale quickly and kind of take this growth and make sure that that we're able to expand and grow responsibly, but also quickly, so that we can actually solve this hunger problem.
And how do you get your volunteers, and do you need to vet them at all, like, you know, check their licenses or anything like that, or just anybody who's willing is able?
I'm sorry?
I was asking how you find your volunteers and whether or not you have to check out their driving records or anything like that. I'm, you know, like, I know Uber certainly has to because they're driving people, but with product, it's probably not the same issue.
No, it's not the same issue. So we don't check a person's driving record. I mean, if they
crash, so anybody can volunteer. And do you have a problem recruiting people, or do you have enough volunteers?
I mean, we have enough volunteers right now, but as we grow, we're going to need to recruit even more. So, you know, aside from us handling the logistics, we're also kind of inspiring everyone to be part of the movement. So we're kind of a two-pronged organization where we're heavily operations-focused, but I also see us as a marketing organization where we're trying to educate consumers and inspire people to, you know, actually take time out of their day to be part of it.
Right, right. Yeah, I would think a lot of the pickups have to happen in the middle of the workday, and that's probably challenging.
Yeah.
And what percentage of foods, like who or what companies are your main suppliers? I know Community Solidarity here gets a tremendous amount of organic stuff from Whole Foods and Trader Joe's. I think they're probably their biggest suppliers. It's amazing how much, you know, they're giving away organic food. It's just beautiful. But where do you get most of your food from?
So we partner with distributors, wholesalers, and groceries, as well as restaurants. The Gordon Food Service, which is one of the top three food distributors in the United States, it's one of our biggest donors. We also partner with a local wholesaler called Paragon Foods, and they are the number one supplier in our region. And one of our most valued partners is Giant Eagle, which is the local grocery store chain. So it's like the Pittsburgh region Safeway or A&P or Wegmans or, yeah, you get the idea.
Do you have Whole Foods and Trader Joe's there?
So we work with Whole Foods and Trader Joe's as well.
Uh-huh. You do. Wow. Amazing. So where do you see yourself going in 5 years? How do you see yourself replicating?
In 5 years, I hope that many, many, many other cities are using our technology and kind of the best practices that we've learned to actually, you know, implement food recovery in their own cities.
That would be so great. I know
the app
just sounds amazing. How long did it take you to develop the app?
So the app is not yet finished. So this is the first phase of an entire platform that we're developing. So it's a three-phase development, and we are embarking. So the app itself took us about a year. And then this year we're embarking on phase two, which, you know, will include the algorithms that we talked about, as well as other improvements to our system. So in the next year, we hope to do phase three. And this year, what we're looking at is porting the app and our platform to other cities, to the beginnings of that.
So you're looking to share the app before you actually finish with stage three, or you want to wait until you – what is stage three?
There's different design elements that we need to prioritize. So it's just that it's just an app that keeps on improving and basically prioritize each phase, and we're delivering versions of the platform every year.
Uh-huh. And so do you need to wait until it's, you know, you've completed that, at least that stage two part with the algorithm before you can share it? Or is that something that you can share it sooner, and then each city can work on finishing it themselves?
No. So we are going to release it in stages. And just like, you know, you receive updates on every app on your phone, it's going to be like that.
Ah, yes. Okay. You can tell I'm not a tech person, so It's a little foreign to me how they work, but they're magical. I do know that.
They are magical.
They are magical, and what they can accomplish is magical. So
yes.
It's just wonderful. So going back to the beer and the brandy that you made, that's not an ongoing situation. It was just a one-shot deal.
I'm sorry?
The partnering with the brewery and the brandy liquor company?
No.
Was that just a one-time?
No, we're going to do seasonal releases of the beer and of the liqueur, and we, you know, with improvements and more interesting stuff every year. So product innovation is also one of our missions. So we're going to continuously introduce products that are made from what would have been food waste.
That's great. I love that. You know, innovation is really, you know, I was talking to an educator who is looking to start a new program at a local university on sustainability and food awareness and have a culinary aspect to it as well. And, you know, I was talking to him how, you know, it just seems like none of these things anymore can really be standalone. They all have to be cooperative and work together with other departments. You need, you know, the business in there, you need the culinary in there, you need the, you know, the innovation, and everybody working together, you know, the whole incubator mentality that comes from people putting a lot of different people with different expertise in one room and seeing what happens. It's just very exciting.
Yep.
So is there anything that I have not asked you that you'd like to share with my listeners? We're just about out of time, but before we finish, and certainly share your website info and, you know, how they would get in touch if they are interested.
Great. One of the other things we didn't talk about, and just briefly, is that we also piloted an ugly CSA last year, and that's basically taking, you know, fruits and vegetables that the farmers couldn't sell at the regular market, and we created a CSA exclusively from those items, and that was really fantastic. And from that, we were also able to measure, you know, what environmental impact we made in saving the resources, specifically blue water, which is drinkable water that went into
right.
it.
Well, I guess we're out of time. I hear our music coming on. So
okay.
Everyone, if you are interested, you can find 412 Food Rescue on the website. I'll be sharing it on my website as well. And Leah, thank you so much for joining us. I'm sorry we're running out of time. And everyone out there, thanks for listening. And I'll see you all again next week.
Thank you.